Previously on Lost.
You cannot change anything. You can't. Even if you try to, it wouldn't work.
Why not?
Whatever happened.
Do you really think all this is an accident? That we, a group of strangers, survived? Many of us with just superficial injuries? You think we crashed on this place by coincidence? Especially this place? We were brought here for a purpose, for a reason, all of us. Each one of us was brought here for a reason.
Horse?
You know Nurse Cole.
You gotta find me, John. You gotta find me. And when you do, you'll find him.
Who?
Jacob.
Two players. Two sides. One is light. One is dark.
We have to go back!
We have to go back!
And welcome to the Storm, a Lost Rewatch podcast for Season 5, Episode 11, Whatever Happened, Happened. Your this week's question is, what game do little Aaron and little Clementine play just off camera while Kate and Cassidy talk this episode? My name is Dave Gonzalez, and you might not have heard of how this game is played, but there's a game called Pogs, and some of them are in elf form.
My name is Joanna Robinson, and it's Lost. It's Lost Babies. They got to play backgammon, of course. Two players, one dark, one light.
And I'm Neil Miller, and I'm thinking that maybe these kids are playing some Hungry Hungry Hippos, because first of all, that game had a super catchy theme song, and you could have little hippos with Dharma logos on them. I'm just saying.
I think if these were two responsible parents and they were within a normal distance of their children, we would have absolutely heard if they were playing Hungry Hungry Hippos.
Yeah, that's true. And they are, as far as we can tell, responsible as parents, both of them.
Yes.
Yeah.
Even if it's sort not of. Their biological. Yeah. Well, I guess that's sort of what this episode of the podcast is about. So we will get there. Hey, if this is your first time joining us, welcome. This podcast is an ideal companion if you're rewatching the ABC series Lost with us or visiting the island for the very first time, because each episode comes in sections for your listening pleasure. First, there is a calm section that only discusses the preceding episodes and avoids all spoilers. And then there's a second section that we call The Storm. It's a storm of spoilers discussing this week's episode in the context of the entire series, of which there isn't that much left, and over a decade of Lost fandom. If all of that sounds good to you, you can look down at your podcasting device and choose your time code where you want to jump in, or just keep barreling along with us as I tell you how to support the show, besides just listening, of course. You could go to patreon.com/stormofspoilers, and there you can subscribe for a monthly rate, and in exchange we give you bonus content, access to our Slack. A whole bunch of things happen in that Slack, including movies, live watches of shows and episodes of Lost, book club. Joanna, what do we have going on these coming weeks in the Slack? Or Patreon subscriber pool?
Yeah, be like Sawyer and get your reading glasses on. More on that in a bit. We're doing book club this week, this month. Shadow and Bone by Leigh Bardugo. Fun fact from our pal Kristen Russo over the Buffering Podcast. They are also reading a Leigh Bardugo book in their book club this month, but it's a different one. So, you know, you can double Bardugo if you want. I mean, I don't recommend it, but you can.
Classic double Bardugo. All right.
We're taking the month off of Feels Like the First Time, but there probably will be another Chen Pop episode with our pal Dave Chen if you want are into that sort of thing for our Patreon subscribers at the $10 level or above. Of course, that is not the only way that you can hang out with us. If you want to, this Saturday in our Patreon support Slack, you can watch the episode Dead is Dead with me, Joanna Robinson. The next episode of Lost, we watch it every Saturday in the Slack. You can also email us, drop some reviews, find us on Twitter at Storm Podcast, go to our website, stormpodcast.com. The emails, of course, should come into host@stormpodcast.com. And the reviews, you know, we usually just prefer Apple, but I understand that not everyone is in the Jobsian cult, so you can leave review wherever you have the ability to leave a review. We do have one review this week that I will be reading from a very like sweet listener who said they were like a little shy, so asked us please not to say their name, but wanted to leave us a review anyway. So 5 stars, really love this podcast. I've been listening since this was a Thrones podcast, and when you moved on to Lost, I was beyond excited. This is probably my 5th or 6th rewatch. I love the calm and get a big kick out of how you all tiptoe around spoilers, but when we get to the storm, I just want the conversation to go on and on. All three hosts bring something unique and their chemistry is the best. And then the person asked us not to say their name, so thank you so much to this person for that lovely review. It is very helpful for us to get the news out to folks who might be doing a Lost rewatch at the tail end of quarantine here and want a companion to go with it. All right, and then we have a couple of emails that I wanted to hit. Sorry again for last week not getting to those emails, but we've got a few to talk about this week. Let's start with this one from Eric, who has a correction for us, I think. Well, okay, so we got one question that we had about the episode last week was whether or not we felt like Ben actually engineered Nadia's death on the show, right? We talked about that in the column, right? Okay.
Maybe. Yeah.
I think so. And I got some people saying the timeline doesn't really work out. Like, Ben gets back and it's kind of like already Nadia's funeral. So it feels like we can't put that one on Ben. But here's this email from Eric who says, I'd like to weigh in on your discussion about whether Ben, in fact, killed Nadia. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. If he didn't kill Nadia, scenario one. Ben didn't kill Nadia. How dare anyone accuse Ben of such a heinous act? By turning him into a suave killing machine to settle the score with vile Chucky Wids. If he did kill Nadia, who cares? She's a... nope, we gotta bleep all of this. Never mind, did not read this through.
Anyway, justice for Nadia, I guess.
Anyway, keep the Ben content flowing, Eric. I think Eric was just being funny, and I should have read that in the storm. I apologize to Eric. Anyway, so what do you guys think? Do you guys want to do any further Ben or Nadia thoughts?
I'm sticking with whatever I said last week.
Okay. I think it could be Ben or Widmore at this time period, given that they're both shadowy operators who seem to... not be like it would sort of mean that Ben was telling the truth, which isn't like the greatest look, but isn't the most insidious truth, the one based on a sort of hazy time travel memory that you know this guy's a killer.
Maybe. do you mean to say like Ben is so sneaky by wrapping his agenda into something that's also true? It's true, and he makes it bend to his agenda.
Yeah, yeah. He like gets out of the exit portal in Tunisia and like checks in, and he reads his new files because he always has updated files.
Oh, I'm sure there were files waiting for him. Yeah,
yeah. And he's like, "Look, this is this all aligned. I could get to Saeed right away. Like, I know how this works."
All right.
That Jack, he's going to be harder.
Okay, so we have an email from Michael here about this episode. Michael very sweetly put calm friendly in the title of this email, so I know that I am in the right place. And this is about this episode, Whatever Happened, Happened. And Michael's email touches on something that I want to discuss anyway, so here we are. Michael writes, I'm writing in with thoughts on Whatever Happened Happened, my favorite Kate episode of the series. Kate Austen is a fantastic character whose storylines do not always do her justice, but I believe this is the point at which the writers finally correct that error. I think this episode is where we see Kate become the best version of herself, similar to how we see Sawyer develop in Lafleur. I find the flashbacks incredibly emotionally engaging, and while I don't love the fact that so many female character storylines become about motherhood in this show, I don't think it takes away from Kate's character the way it unfortunately did for Claire a lot of the time. I think Cassidy is right when she says that Kate needed Aaron, but something major that goes unmentioned is that Kate herself was essentially abandoned by her own parents. She blew up her abusive father, and her mother pretty much disowned her. She's been quote-unquote left behind, a name of a Kate episode, at many points in her life, so it makes complete sense to me that she could not leave Aaron behind, an innocent who she helped bring into the world and a fellow survivor who endured the traumas of the island with her. I love the reorientation of Kate's character, as Joanna described it, as a protector of Claire and Aaron, and I love that her goal in return to the island is completely heroic, because that's who she is. Kate is so much more than a love triangle. She is a hero constantly trying to help people in need, and we see her arc come full circle here. She's no longer running from anything. She's running to something in order to rescue her friend and reunite a family. Evangeline Lilly completely wrecks me emotionally in that goodbye scene with Aaron every damn time I watch it with almost no dialogue. She's incredible and deserves more credit than she gets. This is also a great episode for my favorite character, Dr. Juliet Burke. I love seeing her and Kate work together, and I love the scene between her and Jack in the bathroom. Elizabeth Mitchell is a genius, by the way. Why Jack does not towel off his dripping wet body before putting on a t-shirt is Lost's most upsetting unsolved mystery. Okay, and there's more to Michael's email that's a great little prompt that we're going to get to in a second, but I wanted to check in with you guys about this. I share the sentiment exactly. I think this is the best Kate episode. Reading a bunch of recaps at the time seemed to... Most people seem to think this is the best Kate episode. Maybe the first Kate episode, like, it's hard to beat some of those season one, like, early episodes, but I do think this is the best showcase of what Evangeline Lilly can do. I think she's really, really good in the off-island stuff and the on-island stuff, so I just wanted to see what you guys thought. Maybe you start with Neil.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely agree. I mean, this is a big Kate protagonist check-in episode, and... I think it's definitely the best one we've seen yet. I don't remember if there's a Kate episode in season six, so I reserve the right to change. But yes, very much amazing performances all around, and yeah, I think they finally nail it when they figure out what is driving Kate is the desire to set right, I guess, what happened to Claire. And I think that's a really great motivation for her to go back to the island. It would have been disappointing if her reason had to do with either Jack or Sawyer specifically as to returning to the island.
Yeah, but both men like seem to think it is about them.
Right.
About,
I mean, they definitely think that it's...
none of them were like, oh, you're here for Claire. All right.
Everyone else forgot about Claire.
Right? Yeah. Not Kate. Dave?
Oh, I'm going to forego answering now because I think all this is the meat of the calm.
Okay.
Right?
Maybe I should have saved this for...
No. I think it's good and I love that sentiment and it was worded very perfectly. But in terms of my thoughts Kate and motherhood, we're going to get there.
Oh, okay. Wow. So great email.
Stay tuned.
And also what we're going to be talking about a little bit. Okay. Lastly, Michael says, lastly, I want to include a fun prompt for the comm section that was inspired by a season two podcast I just re-listened to. Joanna, you said that once we got to a certain point in the series, you would rate all of Sawyer's glasses. So this is me holding you to that promise because we're all dying to know. Personally, I don't think anything can beat the season five glasses for me, but that may have something to do with the fact that I would marry Jim Lafleur. So here are some picks for reference, and I will... forward these to you guys so you can take a look at what these glasses look like. So I'm sending these to your email.
Ooh, we're gonna live fun. Rank some glasses.
Yeah, we're gonna rank some glasses. So we're each gonna take a turn trying to describe a pair. So I'm gonna start with season five, the Jim Lafleur glasses, the ones he famously takes off because he cannot believe that Kate, in all her braided hair glory, is here. It's a thin wire rim. You kind of know what they look like. They're pretty just like standard discreet glasses. And then I will go ahead and talk about season one, which is the pair that was soldered together. I think Saeed soldered them together for Sawyer out of like one cat's eye lens and one sort of squarish, and they just look really goofy and pretty hilarious. So those are the season one glasses. Neil, do you want to do season two or season three?
Well, yeah, season two, these are like thin rimmed sort of oval. They're almost like an Edna Mode style, but they're a little more ovular. I don't own or have ever worn glasses, so I don't know how to describe what these are.
I think it's a tortoiseshell number that we're looking at there. Yeah.
Yeah. He's using to read Lancelot in season two.
Yes. And then Dave, do you want to describe season three?
So season three are a little bit more rectangular, like, say, the season fives, almost as if they were, like, built to be reading glasses. But the notable thing about it is there's a hair tie Harry Pottering the center of them together. And
what does Harry Pottering mean to you?
It's when, before he meets Hermione on the train, his glasses are broken in the center on the nose, mm-hmm. and they have to be refused together. He used tape. In this case, Sawyer is using a hair tie.
I don't know how a hair tie would do that job, but right? it does look like that is, or it's like wire or something, but definitely something.
I can't imagine. I just assumed it would be a hair tie because that'd be something you could then use on your nose. Like if that's wire, that's like,
oh, that's an extremely painful pair of glasses.
But if it's like, it's like wrapped wire, do you know what I mean? Like one would use in a bomb. Wire? Yeah. all right, so I'm going to go with, rank number one is the glasses that are closest to mine own, which are the season two glasses that Neil described as Edna Mode-esque. Mm-hmm. Number two are the classic season five glasses. Number three, just for memories and charm and giggles, I'm going to go season one Franken glasses. And then in last place is going to be the Harry Potter spectacles. Harry Potter. What do you guys think?
Mm-hmm. I'm going to put one at the top.
Yeah, I also think
just like a charming desert island chic.
I like the underdogs personally. Yeah, it's like season one, season three, and then, you know, season five, season two.
And season two at the end. Yeah, season two kind of looks like... like he has snowboarding goggles that
they look
out of.
Great on a writer from Vanity Fair. Okay, great.
They look too nice to have been found on the island in season two.
It's true. All right, so let's talk about a little bit about, well, I guess I'll save this because I feel like Dave's not going to want to talk about it until we get into the meat of the episode. So we've got an email from Sarah about Ben.
Ooh. A baby Ben.
And all right, let's go with this question from Marlon. Marlon says, one question I had when I was thinking about these recent episode is why our main cast decided to join the Dharma Initiative and not the others. This is a good question, and I think the answer is it's more fun and complicated to be in the Dharma Initiative. But okay. So in the episode The Floor, Sawyer makes a deal with Richard so that he, Juliet, Miles, and Daniel could stay in Dharmaville. Looking back at that, wouldn't have made more sense if Sawyer had made the deal for a main cast to stay with Richard and his people instead. In Namaste, Hurley points out that the entire Dharma Initiative gets wiped out and put into a mass grave. Yes, Sawyer didn't know about that genocide at the time that he made his deal with Richard, but even still, going with Richard would have made more sense. Do we know that Sawyer didn't know about the Dharma side? Who knows about it? Is it only like John and Ben and Hurley? Is that it?
Yeah, maybe. I mean,
Juliet has to know, right?
Maybe.
I mean, you would assume that Ben would have done one of his intimidating walk you to the edge of the mass grave with Juliet at some point, because that's like his move.
Maybe it was enough to take her on a walk and show her a Shishka Goodwin.
Well, yeah, but how do you top that next time she steps out of line? You got to take her to the Dharma pit.
It's true. Nothing tops Shishka Goodwin other than a pit of, you know, your own people. All right. Okay. So let's say in Namaste, Let me pick up where Marlin left off. He said, it would have meant that Sawyer and his team wouldn't have had to pretend they weren't something they weren't. As Juliet pointed out in a previous episode, she was de facto one of Richard's people already. She spoke Latin, which is the language that Richard's people speak, so she would have felt more of a kinship with Richard than anyone in Dharmaville. At least Richard is someone who Juliet has known for some years, even before Sawyer showed up. In whatever happened, I get why Jack wouldn't want to help Ben, but it seems if he would be smart enough to want to go to see Richard, maybe join with Richard, because Richard would know better what's going on with the island than even anyone in Dharma Initiative. For certain, Hurley should be the one leading that charge. Hurley would want to go to Richard and join them, because again, it's Hurley who points out that the Dharma Initiative gets wiped out. Kate hasn't revealed why she came back to the island, but whatever the reason, it's not to hang out with the Dharma Initiative. Wouldn't it also make sense for her to stay with Richard and try to get his help or counsel? Just knowing there's a ticking clock to Dharma Initiative, Dharma side, it just never really makes sense that our main cast would stay there. But what say you, Marlin? I think you're right. And also, it doesn't make for as good TV. So you're both right. And
also, never underestimate what people will do to be able to use indoor plumbing.
yeah.
Like, that would be my reason. Like, Richard seems cool and everything, but those people live in the jungle. That does not sound fun. And our losties sort of know that that's not fun. So, yeah, man, beds and showers, let's do it. Sign me up. Namaste.
I mean, I think most of all, Marlin is advocating for more Richard on the show, and I can't disagree with that request. Yes. So, you know. Dave, do you have anything to say about this?
No, I mean, I could see why the latter three who get flashed into 1977 don't, because Sawyer's just sort of like, listen, this is the way it's going to go. It's going to be fine. And look how it turns out for Saeed, who rejects that, you know, call. So I'm going, but I don't have a good reason for why Sawyer, like, other than maybe, like, the entire time that Sawyer is on the island, and he's on the island all the time, the others are still, like, a threatening force. He isn't, like, part of the inner workings of John Locke when him and Sawyer are sort of on the same page. But that's a flimsy excuse. I like the excuse that it's easier for the show. We want to be with the Dharma Initiative.
Yeah,
the others have the answers, and the show doesn't want to show you the answers.
Completely. All right, and then the last thing I'll say before we hop over to Neil is that someone wrote in response to a phrase, something that I said last week, which was, I think it was last week, said something about hurt people, which is something that our friend Kitty Rich and I talk about a lot. This idea that, like, if you are, you know, in reference to Ben Linus, like, if you know, trauma is something that can be passed down sort of through the generations. Someone wrote in, like, asking me to be a little bit more mindful with my words there. And I will say this, absolutely. And I'm not even using this in the sneering, ironic, not all men way. Not all hurt or traumatized. It's certainly not true that if you have trauma or experience abuse or whatever it is growing up, that you will then become a traumatizer. That is not a given. You know, there are plenty of people who have, through work on themselves or various other things, managed to break that cycle. So I didn't mean to imply that that was true of all people who experience that, but certainly can be true of plenty of people. So I just wanted to thank you for that email again. I thanked you in the email. I'll thank you on air and be a little bit more mindful of when I talk about that in the future. And let me hand it over to Neil, who's going to tell us what happened on Lost this week.
Yes. This episode, Whatever Happened, Happened, was directed by Bobby Roth and written by Carlton Cuse and Damon Lindelof. It aired on April 1st, 2009. We'll come back to that. It takes place on maybe 2, maybe 3 days after the arrival of Ajira Flight 316 on the island. In flashbacks, we finally learn what Kate did for Sawyer and what Kate did with Aaron. For Sawyer, she went to visit Cassidy and drop off an envelope of money for Clementine. Later, we see what happened after Kate left the docks. After almost losing Aaron in a grocery store, she consults again with Cassidy and decides to give Aaron to his grandmother so that she can go back to the island. Her reason for returning? A promise to find Claire. On the island, Dharmaville is in chaos following the escape of Saeed and the shooting of Ben. And while Miles and Hurley debate the rules of time travel, Sawyer tries to convince Jack to help Tiny Ben. But because Jack is a huge fan of testing these new time travel rules, he refuses. When it becomes clear that nothing more can be done for little Ben, Juliet and Kate decide to take him to the others. And after sending Sawyer to help Kate, Juliet gives Jack a piece of her mind. Out in the jungle, Richard Alpert agrees to help, carrying Ben to the mysterious temple where he will be healed. The only catch is that he's not ever going to be the same again. It all ends with adult Ben Linus, still alive, back on the island, waking up to an also very much alive John Locke, who welcomes him back to the land of the living. Fun fact about this episode. This episode was broadcast, as I mentioned, on April 1st, 2009, which apparently some people call March 32nd. This is something that I'm learning. And it shares a central theme of the story March Has 32 Days from Mystery Tales number 40, the comic book that was one of the items that Richard showed to young John Locke in the episode Cabin Fever. In the 1956 comic story, a time traveler tries to alter history when he relives a day in his own past after struggling with the question of whether it would be possible to do anything differently if he had the opportunity to go back in time. Same argument that Hurley and Miles are having in this episode. There was an ARG, which we've talked about. These are alternate reality games, marketing things. That came out in summer of 2008, in which the Lost creators embedded the comment, March has 32 days, as a clue in the ARG's first email. So, nice little tie-in there. This week's column question, if you were living in the 1970s Dharmaville and April 1st rolled around, I'm a big fan of April Fool's Day pranks, the nice ones, the harmless ones. Do you think that, is there a prank that you would play living in Dharmaville on someone? And I'll give you an example. And this required me to research some like real world. All my pranks are like website based, and they don't have websites in the Dharma initiative that I know of, unless they have like a zine, right? Like if they put out a Dharma zine. Anyway, I saw this prank online where you take a harmonica and put it in the grill of someone's car. And it makes, as they're driving, it makes their car sound funny, despite the fact there's nothing wrong to it. So I would do that to Jin as a prank, but then I would feel bad because Jin would have been hearing the sound as he was driving back with a Ben that's bleeding out in the back. So that's how my prank would go wrong. Do you guys have any, have you ever done April Fool's pranks? Do you have a go-to prank?
In college, I did like a... And when I lived in the dorms, I did like a classic, like put some dye in the shower heads move. And also, we tied everyone's doorknobs together down up and down the hallway. And then like someone, maybe RA, I forget who, we did that like in the middle of the night, and someone, maybe RA, came and cut all the rope that we used because it's a fire hazard, which fair enough. that was, I would do like one of those, just like whatever is the most mean-spirited prank, I would do it to Rosinski. I would like wrap everything in the flame station in saran wrap or something like that. Just really piss Rosinski off.
Put the model of the swan in jello.
Yes, exactly.
I would steam all the labels off Lafleur's records because he's still the neighborhood sheriff, and I don't feel bad about that.
Ooh, I just thought of another good one. I would take all of the signs from all the stations. You know how they have like the Swan Station has its own logo, and this would take a long time. And I would just swap them. So you go show up at the flame, and it's like, you have arrived at the Looking Glass. It'll be very confusing and fun.
I love how Miller. They look nothing alike, so you wouldn't be confused, but you would just be like, what's happening?
Why is that
Neil
here?
Workman's been here!
Neil Workman strikes again.
Definitely a very good Kate episode. I want to swing back to the meat of that, because I think it's very interesting how this episode is placed in the season to provide a really great pivot to Kate sort of, I guess, running towards things is how it was put in the email. Like, not only is she in the past returning to the island to go save Claire, but is an active force in trying to save baby Ben. Just because he's a kid. Same as Juliet. Probably, but at least, you know, the action version of Kate on the island. It's interesting because I think it's artful and not just a way that they managed to write themselves out. But how do we feel now knowing the backstory about the period of time where we had Kate show up at Jack's crying, having just left Aaron in a motel, presumably, and sort of being like, don't ask me about this. Wouldn't this be something that Kate would feel fine sharing with people, like that this is her goal?
Well, she doesn't say don't ask me why I'm going back. She just says don't ask me about Aaron. And I think given how shitty Jack has been about Aaron and how judgmental and weird and awful, I wouldn't feel the need to share what I decide to do with him, with Jack. Mm-hmm. Jack hasn't earned that.
I mean, it's more about Jack than anything else.
Yeah.
I mean, when was that scene? When did we first see that scene? This was only a couple episodes ago, right? I mean, it still feels...
Jack-centric, so it's what, 316?
It still feels pretty patient of the show to then string that out for a couple episodes. I mean, I think one of my sort of overarching thoughts is that we've had some time with, like, the season 5 sort of slows down in the middle in a nice way, and we get like LaFleur, Namaste, He's Our You, but it really starts right at the end of He's Our You. We start to get this kick of momentum, and I like that this episode not only spends some time going back and giving us, you know, fleshing out the story of why Kate has returned to the island, because I think that's super important. It's also kickstarting what feels like momentum for the rest of the season. It feels like we're turning the corner, and things are going to start happening. It's a great episode. It's a great mid-season episode, you know, like just right here in the middle.
Yeah.
This season
and
is
reorients
so good.
The character in an amazing way. Sorry, go ahead, Joanna.
Well, yeah, the season is just so good. Like, when's the last time we had a bad episode this season?
Mm-hmm.
It's so good. And, yeah, exactly. It reorients the character. Like, you're really worried. Even these first couple days that she's back on the island, that, like, it's just gonna be Kate and glances at Sawyer and glances at Jack and Jack glances at Sawyer, stuff like that. And you get, like, a little bit of that. And then Kate's like, JK, I'm not here for you. Like, it's not what's happening. and there's a little bit of that there, obviously, like she is sort of like, well, you seem to be doing fine with Juliet, why couldn't you do this with me, sort of thing. It's interesting. I do want to talk about Cassie's analysis, which I mostly agree with but somewhat don't. I don't know if that feels like me moving on to a different topic.
Yeah, let's do it.
Well, so Cassie has two exchanges with Kate where she, you know, is positioned as this great truth teller, right? And one is, what a coward. Like, he jumped out of the helicopter because he was afraid of being with you. And Kate pushes back on that a little bit. And Cassie's like, no, this is my experience with him. I think I'm right. And then the second one is like, you needed Aaron because your heart was broken by Sawyer. Okay, so I agree with the first one, actually, because we have evidence for that in the show. Sawyer leading up to the big freighter rescue, Sawyer having this whole, like, what do I have to go back for? Like, I'm someone here, and I wasn't anyone I wanted to be back home, and I'm at least someone here. Why wouldn't I just stay here? Kate, don't you just kind of want to stay here with me and build a life in Dharmaville? And Kate's like, no. Thanks. And so that makes sense to me. Like, Sawyer jumps not only because of Kate, but just in general, he just did not want to go back home and see what that would be like. That was not something he was ready to do. It's still not something he's ready to do in 1974. He's like, Juliet, don't you want to come build a life with me here in Dharmaville instead of getting on the sub and going back to the mainland? And she's like, okay. And then the part where Cassie's like, your heart was broken by Sawyer, so what else were you going to do? Kate didn't really strike me. Like, her whole, like, identity and raison d'etre was not tied up in Sawyer at the end of season three. Like, she felt drawn to him, but she also felt drawn to Jack. And so she wasn't, it wasn't like, she was like, this is it. This is the man I want to spend the rest of my life with. Oh no, he just jumped out of a helicopter. What am I going to do? Like, that wasn't really where she was. So I kind of reject that assessment from Cassidy. What do you guys think?
The way I could talk into it making sense is Kate needs an anchor, whether that's a child she has to take care of or whether it's an outlaw boyfriend who finally settles down. I think either of those could have worked. I don't think she was a child
or a man child. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, exactly. I don't think she consciously made a choice. I just think her heart was yearning for a reason not to run because everything in her would tell her to run. I don't think it necessarily had to do with the interpersonal relationships, but like Kate did need something after she got off the island to make it so she didn't run.
I agree with that. Like, that she needed Aaron. I'm just not sure I agree with Cassidy's reason why she needed Aaron.
Yeah, the heartbreak thing is, like, that's a very Cassidy lens projecting to see things through.
Yeah. What do you think?
Well, and I think that the point about how it wasn't all necessarily about the Kate and Sawyer relationship right there, right before they got off the island. Like, if you think back, the triangle that I think we were concerned about, or the triangle that the show was concerned about, was Jack and Kate and Juliet. And despite the fact that, like, we knew, being people who had seen the show before, that the Sawyer-Juliet thing was coming, I don't know if it's that super clear at that point. You know, and yeah, I don't know. I think that's probably the most important thing, is that, you know, yeah, Kate and Sawyer had their thing and they had a falling out, but especially right there before the helicopter scene, it didn't feel like Sawyer was making, you know, some romantic. It didn't feel like Sawyer was making an entirely romantic choice based on not wanting to go build a life with Kate. You know, he was also saving his friends. So,
give a little bit of credit to
pre-LaFleur
Sawyer.
he gets hero points for sure. Sure. Like, I'm not going to take all his hero points away from him. But I think it's sort of like what we were talking about with, like, Ben getting Saeed to kill for him. It's like there's one reason, which is true, which is I want to save my friends and Hurley, who he cares about as well, and all of that. And then there's the other, like, and it was an easier choice for him to make because it aligned with the thing that he was afraid of, right?
Right. Yeah. Well, yeah, and this way he didn't have to worry about the Kate situation or his daughter.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, no, he piled it all at the thing. He's like, if Kate knew I was abandoning a daughter, she also wouldn't like me, but also she's the one who could go check on my daughter and I could stay on the island. And also, Hurley's very sensitive about his weight, and this would make him feel good, and really I love him above all these other women.
Yeah. I do think it's interesting that we did wait a long time to get the revelation of what exactly it was that Sawyer whispered to Kate, even though, like, we could have guessed, maybe, but definitely plenty of people made this guess, but that's a multi-season payoff for what it was. You know, it was not Hail Hydra. It was, there's this woman, her name is Cassidy. She lives here. She has a daughter. Her name is Clementine. That's my daughter. Can you find her?
Yeah. I mean, and it brought Cassidy back. So it was all worth it.
A lot of information in that very quick whisper, but yeah.
on a helicopter, right, that is making noise and going down.
So timeline wise, Cassidy sees the news about the oceanic god damn it,
it's okay.
Flight 815 survivors.
I got a WandaVision email from a listener who says I pronounce the word prophesied. Fuck, now I can't remember. It really hurt my head. Well, if something is, maybe I'll just stop using that word and say foretold or something like that. But if something is like, what do you say?
How
do
oh,
you
spell like prof? The- oh yeah, like if you're a prophet, if you prophesize? No.
Something is okay. So there's a prophecy.
Yeah.
Right.
Prophesize.
Prophecy, yeah. But
prophesize.
But no. But the thing. Prophecy? I'll spell it for you.
We're gonna get into that thing where like a word becomes a sound.
P R O P H E C I E D.
Prophesied?
It's prophesied, but I think I was pronouncing it prophesied.
Oh, okay.
But it's prophesied. But I hate that. My brain hates it. I will concede it's true. My brain hates it, so I will just never say it again. That's my solution. Anyway, sorry. Oceanic is what you're trying to say, Dave.
Yeah, oceanic. 8:15, the Oceanic Six. So she's watching the news, and she's like, oh, heist girl is one of the six. And then she's like watching the list of the dead, and she's like, oh, my Clementine's father was also on that flight and is now like dead. And then the first time they all sort of process it is at the door in this episode, and they're like, hey, Sawyer sent me. And that's not surprising to her, right? That's we have to assume she knew it from the news.
Does she know Sawyer was on the flight?
I mean, before Kate gets there?
Yeah.
And would his That's name have been released as one of the dead? Yeah, I guess so. James Ford.
Would she have pored over the names of the dead of the Oceanic flight?
Oh, I don't know.
I don't know that she knew he was dead. He disappeared from her life. He left her money, disappeared from her life. So she had no reason to like...
Either way, he might as well have been dead.
He could have died in Australia and she wouldn't have known necessarily. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? So
I'm just saying, like, in a world where we have a corner called I Married Her, a Coincidence Corner, weren't we robbed of the moment where Kate's like, hey, good to see you again. Sawyer sent me.
Yeah, but I guess we already experienced that when we got the first Kate and Cassidy episode. That was the big I married her moment for the audience. So, like, how would it have been narratively satisfying for us to watch Cassidy process information that we already knew?
I mean, probably not. But then again, every time somebody on this show describes the plot of the show up to this point, I find it endlessly entertaining. So
it would have been fun. I would have enjoyed
Kate's throw at it.
Yeah, it would have been fun to see Kate try to tell the story. Because now and we've I got saw yeah, Hurley horse, and Saeed.
And then there were some others.
Only, no, if Hurley had been there, maybe. But if Kate had been like, I brought my friend Hurley, and he's going to explain to you what happened.
Right, there you go.
I would have had a great time.
Also, Cassidy is very good. She knows a lot of stuff.
She's great.
Yeah. I wouldn't put it past her to have figured out that Sawyer was on the plane.
Yeah, maybe she just had she's been keeping track of him in prisons and on planes.
I just have never once checked the flight manifest of a plane that has crashed to see if perchance I knew anyone on board.
Well, I guess it would prompt me if I found out that I knew somebody who survived. I don't know if I would. Yeah, I feel like maybe I would read a little more into it because she knew Kate.
But yeah. She didn't like know her. She was like, oh, I've grifted with that lady once.
Is it beyond that? Would it be creepy? Because if I tried to explain that situation to somebody, it would sound creepy. Being like, I had a child with a woman, and now I stalk the woman from afar. And, you know, look at down plane lists and, you know, always try to keep a tab on her. Maybe it's creepy. Maybe
it's
she didn't.
Not that. I mean, I don't think it's that creepy when there's like a kid involved. And you sure. want to keep tabs on the kid's biological parent. Like, I am willing to excuse a lot of, like, watchful behavior for that reason. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. For the children.
Can you imagine how much child support he owes at this point?
Cool. He sent her a ton of money in that very forgettable prison episode. Remember that episode where he's in prison? And he got all that money and he sent it to her. So, yeah.
So there you go.
Also, while we're in the flashback, Kate loses Aaron in a supermarket when he wants milk, and then changes his mind to a juice box, and then goes, understandably, to the produce section, because where there is fruit, there will certainly be juice boxes. But I wanted to point out that there's an extra who gets not one, but two lines. It doesn't even need to be a meat sock on the island. That just has to be like a prime, I'm going to be on Lost in its peak, you know, sort of gig. Because I get to, you know, do a scene with Evangeline Lilly and I get two lines fee. He probably got to eat at the Good Craft Services.
Yeah.
That's what they call food service on sets.
And we also get the lady who vaguely looks like Claire. I think this was a debate as we were live watching it, was how much does this lady look like Claire? And I think, you know,
I think from behind, enough.
Sure. It's enough to where you believe that maybe the kid was confused. I don't know.
Or enough that you believe that Kate's spooked by it.
Right. Yeah.
That's, she looks, her hair looks enough like Emily DeRaven's hair looked like before she started wearing wigs, to make me believe that Kate would be spooked to be like, holy shit, was that, you know.
Is this like, the island sending me a sign?
Was the grocery store smoke detector going on? Right.
I've never been on the parent side of that situation, but I definitely have traumatic memories of being a child and like following somebody who was wearing similar pants to one of my parents, and then suddenly realizing I had been following a different person. But from what I could tell in our live chat, that the feeling of losing a child in the grocery store is one of those, you know, fantastic terrors that is even creepier when there are mysterious agents from an island of mystery / the Widmore Corporation that could be out to get your child. So good job amping up the tension. Not sure if that you would then leave him in a motel room by himself, but we'll sacrifice that logic.
Yeah,
for good storytelling.
I have a few questions about that, but there is I do want to really quickly interject something that I want to make sure that we're a little sensitive about, which is which I've run in before talking about biological parents versus non-biological parents, which is like for people who are adopted or who adopt kids, they're really sensitive to this idea of like being a biological parent, being a non-biological parent means you're not really a parent. And I don't think anyone on this podcast is making that argument at all. And I even think that like Ben, who like sort of tries to put the screws to Kate by telling her that's not her kid, or Cassidy, who does something similar, I don't think they even really believe that, especially Ben, who raised a girl who's not his biological kid.
Ben.
Yeah.
One time. Ben. Yeah. Okay.
But I think the show is maybe not always 1,000% sensitive about making that distinction, but I do think I don't think there should be a distinction necessarily, but I think putting that aside, I do think Kate's guilt around Claire and her drive to find Claire is one of the best things that the show does, honestly. And it turns this whole question of like, where's Claire, which is something that the audience was asking when like Emily DeRaven just disappears from the show in this season, it turns it into a plot point. Whereas Claire is no longer like, well, we didn't really know what to do, so we sort of gave Emily the season off and put her in a cabin, maybe, I don't know. And it turns it into Kate's quest, which is so smart, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, and I mean, it's a fantastic turn for the character, and you know, I really like the moment where Kate is describing how they lost Claire. Like, there just seems, and you can kind of see it in Evangeline Lilly's face, like it's just a genuine like guilt about the fact that Claire just straight up disappeared, and it was very confusing, and it all happens at the end. Like right as all this other chaos is happening, they're trying to get off the island. So you can imagine that being a thing that would weigh on your conscience, you know, and on top of the fact that as one of the Oceanic Six, Kate knew that they were leaving all these other people, you know, at that time they left like 40 people. They didn't know that they all got hit with flaming arrows like a day later.
Kate's like, I'm here for Froggert.
Right. Kate's like, where's Neil?
Well, I think also her conveying that to Sawyer in that scene is so strong, mm-hmm. not just because it's, you know, we've got his little like puppy dog face when he's asking about Clementine, his like the weird torn place that he's in between Juliet and Kate, but also like remember that it was Sawyer who like was with Claire and like freaked out when she disappeared, and certainly of like all the people they lost, like that's someone that he feels a lot of tremendous personal guilt around, you know, mm-hmm. himself. So
yeah,
it's good. No,
they shouldn't
stuff,
have forgotten about Claire. No. Everyone forgot about Claire except for like a few people.
Except for Kate.
Well, it was conveniently plotted, so it seemed like everybody forgot about Claire for a long period of time. But if what I'm told is correct in this show, soon after the docks, Kate was thinking about Claire, and we've been back at the docks over and over again. So good job, Kate, for not forgetting about Claire. We knew you had it in you.
You know who is really on the hook for forgetting about Claire? Claire's actual blood relative, Jack Shepard.
That
who
is true.
Now at this point is aware that that is his half sister.
Yeah, like Jack's not there for his actual sister.
He is
no,
making
sir.
Sandwiches.
I like how when we go and we see Claire's mom again, she recaps that scene where Jack came in. And it's just like, and then he just like left without explaining who Aaron was. And I'm like, of course. Jack, so close to doing the right thing, and then just storms out because there's something else that needs to be rushed to do.
It was raining. Kate was waiting in the car. He had to go.
Yeah.
But I mean, shout out to Claire's mom for not totally freaking out, because all of this is extremely wild.
That's true. Yeah. You get a whole, not only is your daughter alive, but you have a grandchild, and I'm going back to get your daughter from an island?
Sure.
Long story.
Sure. I mean, it's good news. It's just, it's chaotic and it's all happening at once.
Yeah. And then suddenly you have a dependent.
Right.
Jack has that great line to Kate where he's like, you didn't like the old me either, Kate, which is a really good line, I think, mm-hmm. and well delivered. But like, let's remember the old Jack. The old Jack is someone who was like so abusive in their relationship that Kate didn't feel like she could tell him she was going to see Cassidy and Clementine. Like that's where she was every time that Jack got mad. She was like visiting Cassidy and Clementine so often that Clementine calls her Auntie Kate, and she didn't feel like she could tell Jack because he was not a safe person to be around. So because
it's
of his weird Sawyer fixation. So.
Mm-hmm.
Because of a lot of his fixations at the time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. His new fixation just seems to be like a meh, which is fine. But when you're king, the island's going to take care of it. That seems like a lock to me. So as I say in the notes, Jack's the lock now. And as Joanna added, Jack's the lock now, dog.
We've come full circle on the man of science, man of faith thing, because Jack is in full trust of both the island here and apparently the rules of time travel as described by Miles. I mean, it's one of those where it's like, I really do every time I watch that scene, I'm like, Jack's working it out and he really wants to see if this time travel thing is real. Like that's because otherwise this is insane.
You know that line from I think it's The Last Jedi. When Kylo Ren says, like, no, you're still holding on, right? Like, Jack wants to be John Locke, but he's still holding on a little bit to his Jackiness. Do you know what I mean? It's still mm-hmm. there. He's not quite there yet. Like, in that scene with Juliet, which is a phenomenal scene when Juliet's like, everyone get out, I need to have some words with Jack.
Yeah, I mean, if Elizabeth Mitchell ever looked at me with that face, I would die on the spot. I would be so dead, I would just burst into dust.
But he says, I don't know yet. You know what I mean? Like, he's just sort of like, he's kind of trusting to Isla and stuff, but he also, like, his Jack still comes through, like, when he comes up to Horace, and Horace is like, excuse me, who are you? Jack's like, Dr. Jack Shepherd.
Yeah, excuse me, we're on a TV show, I'm one of the main characters.
And he's like, okay, Jack Workman, and he's like, damn it.
I mean, I think he settles in, well, then he settles into, you know, showering bliss. And as we pointed out, as an email pointed out, but I think we need to return to, Jack puts a shirt on after coming out of the shower without drying off his torso, which is eerily reminiscent of not rolling up his pant legs before putting them into the pool.
Oh my god.
On his wedding weekend.
I forgot about that.
I guess the thing that bothers me most about this, and I was, probably still am, it's been a while since I've been to a public pool, but like I was the public pool kid who would get out and put a shirt on immediately because I had some body issues as a teenager. So I've done it, and I can tell you that it's extremely uncomfortable to have a wet shirt on. This is just, come on.
Yeah, and it's an island, so it's got to be, like, the humidity is not nothing. It's going to take forever for that to...
Mm-hmm.
He was just so embarrassed by his tattoo, he didn't want Juliet. Like, Juliet was already chewing him out. He's like, don't give her more ammunition. Cover up the tattoo.
What's the five for? Well, oh, wait. Oh, never mind.
I also love the idea that, or this sort of how Jack flirts with getting involved, and how Horace seems to sort of suspect him. And if it wasn't for Jim LaFleur being maybe the best head of security the Dharma Initiative has ever seen, and with, you know, figuring out what happened to Roger's keys, Jack could have been in a lot of trouble, because Jack was sort of on the list of people who may have helped Said escape.
A three-person list.
Right.
And Jack found himself on a three-person list.
Right. He needs to send Sawyer a thank you card for this one.
I love everything with Sawyer and Roger and the keys, because Sawyer is so smooth when he asks about it. Like, even I am, like, fooled for a second that he's not, like, on the hunt. And then later Roger's like, that son of a bitch doesn't ask any questions he doesn't know the answer to already. It's, like, so good. Jim LaFleur. ACAB, but mm-hmm. maybe not you. Okay, probably.
It's okay. His records are useless.
You have steamed them.
I have steamed them. There are no labels. The sound quality is probably different. It's like, don't worry about it. He could be a good person to solve crimes, and still have some steamed records. Speaking of Roger Workman.
Mm-hmm.
After having to kind of like turn it up to 11 with the abusive dad-ness of him, basically so we could have the surprise of Ben getting shot later in the episode, we kind of do some balancing of the Roger Workman character through the eyes of Kate. Is Kate flirting with Roger Workman? Joanna?
I just think Evangeline Lilly has chemistry with, like, the winch itself. You know what I mean? Like,
she has chemistry with the burnt Dharma van.
If she, like, smiles at you, you're just sort of like, oh, I've gotten in here with this lady. Yeah. Which is certainly, it kind of seems what Roger thinks at this moment.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's another one of these great moments where a character has traveled back in time, realizes something. Similar to like Juliet picking up the baby and being like, oh, look at this cute baby. And Amy being like, yeah, he's Ethan. And her being like, shit. I think Kate is like fine with Roger up to the point where he says his last name. And then it's like, oh, you're the guy.
Oh,
But I do enjoy that they still find some like interesting sort of humanizing moments for Roger. It's weird that they're doing it a week after showing him to, you know, re-showing us that he's an abusive, you know, piece of shit. So, but I like that. I just like it for Kate's character. Cause I think that, you know, Kate, I don't know, she goes through this episode and ultimately is the one who pushes everyone to do the right thing, which is don't let the kid die. But, you know, when we finally get to the end and we learn that this is going to change Ben, is it the right thing? I guess that's the debate. But I like that Kate is like, she believes she's doing the right thing. She's not necessarily like, I don't know. She's not like mean to Roger. Then again, I guess she doesn't know about how Roger's a shitty dad.
I like Kate's bond with Roger here. I mean, I do think it's a little too hard of a swerve from like how shitty Roger is to Ben.
It's a real 180
to this episode, but I prefer that the show try to find the human rather than just like give us Rudzinski-esque monsters. Mm-hmm. You know, I like that it's trying to find the human motivation behind Roger's shittiness.
Yeah, because I mean, we know that it ends terribly for Roger.
Yeah,
because that definitely happened and will happen again.
All this has happened before.
Because whatever happened happened. Superfluous comma in the title or no? All right. Where do we want to go from here? I feel like there are some key moments. We got Temple, but I also feel like if we keep going to Temple, we're going to leave behind the Kate cry moment, which we keep touching on, but. There is a Kate's goodbye to Aaron / handing off to the grandmother. It's an effective scene despite logically not making a ton of sense just because Evangeline Lilly is incredibly good at her job.
I agree. Mm-hmm. It makes no sense for her to leave. Like, why not drop the baby at Cassidy's and be like, hey, lady. Come pick up your grandson. Bye.
Yeah, he's safe somewhere else. Not
he's safe with someone he
you.
Knows. Not he's gonna wake up alone / with a stranger.
Do you I think told that him Kate, when he woke like, up, the person that was be there was his grandmother. He lived with her now.
It'll be fine.
Do you think she waited outside until she saw the grandmother go to the other room?
I mean, hopefully.
Like,
otherwise,
she just
that's
sit
like
in the car and
the
like,
beginning
be sad.
Of a horrible fairy tale where yeah. it's like, I'm the person your mother sent.
Oh, Jesus. Yeah,
oh, no.
I know. Kay listened to like both sides of her Patsy Cline Greatest Hits cassette in the car while waiting for her. It's Evangeline Lilly crushing it, but it's also that rat bastard Michael Giacchino.
Oh yeah,
because it's the raft theme. He throws the raft theme on there. I'm pretty sure, and I start losing it every time. And then by the time she gets to Bye Bye Baby, I'm gone. I'm on another planet, and it's made of tears. So
damn your piano, Giacchino.
It's really tough.
Oh no, there's okay. So that he uses. Yeah, it's the rat. There's he uses both. He uses the Wrath theme, and then he uses the There's No Place Like Home, which is the Oceanic 6 theme, like when they're reuniting with their families.
Mm-hmm.
It's just killing all of it. He really brings it home in this one.
All right, now that we're out of the past, or we go further into the past, which is our future, where baby Ben has been shot. So we get, I feel like we've said that Kate is a motivating factor in this, which she is, and she's definitely very active, but it's Juliet who, manages to finally motivate Sawyer to carry a limp baby Ben, past the sonic fence and, towards the others, because Juliet's just not gonna let a kid die. She hasn't started successfully delivering babies on this island to start watching little children die. Time be damned. But she does motivate Sawyer out there, which leads them to Richard, who has an ultimatum that is very confusing about he can maybe do something, but Ben won't remember anything, and he will never be the same. He will always be one of us. So, in terms of Ben not remembering this, whatever the vagaries of this is, being shot, being carried by Sawyer through the jungle, like, I don't know what he's not remembering. But when Ben said that he was, like, born on the island, was that, like, a clever half-truth? Are we about to see the birth of the evil Ben in some sort of temple-ness.
Oh, I see.
He's like, you know, these are my people. He's always been very insistent the others were his people. And the big reveal in The Man Behind the Curtain is like, oh, the others weren't always his people. He wanted to, like, join them. But this would seem to sort of re-indicate that at least he will always be an other now. Some sort of, like, I don't know.
Like he was reborn on the island.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like a another baptism.
Yeah, I mean, rebirth is a theme that we're working with here in this season. So, yeah, that tracks.
So if that happens, and then we have John Locke rebirthed a couple episodes back, but we return to that at the end of this episode, is it like one of the tenets of being like a leader of like the others, like some sort of forced rebirth? Seems odd, but seems like a whole bunch of weird echoes and connections are happening. I just don't know necessarily. It's like that perfect hole that Lost tends to form, where it's just enough that I feel like I learned something, but the more I try to break down what the actual rules are, I get lost in some sort of vagaries. Does anybody have some solid facts about what Richard does with Ben in this episode?
No, it's an island magic thing, right? Like, he's not going to remember this. What does that mean, like, the last 3 years? Does that mean the last, like, 30 minutes?
Is that why? I mean, that's probably why Ben doesn't remember, like, show up as Henry Gale and be like, oh, you, this is odd.
Yeah. I mean, this is something that I keep, this is an emotion that I remember every time I rewatch this episode, which was the idea that as soon as Jack says, let him die, the idea that the big question of the episode is how are they going to work around the fact that Jack's not going to save Ben? And I think ultimately what they came up with is a pretty clever solution, which is like some sort of island magic in the temple has changed Ben, because it does kind of give them room to cover up some of these other, you know, the Ben inconsistencies that I feel like we've been talking about since he was Henry Gale, you know, at least in the storm. So I think it's fairly clever, and I think it works, and it is confusing if you start asking too many questions about it, but, you know, what are you going to do? Season 5. This is the bed we made.
Yeah. Is dead dead? Man, maybe I should watch the next episode.
I hope there's
episode.
Another episode that's going to answer that question.
Yeah, that seems to be a really important question the show is posing.
I will say one of the things that I find, because you mentioned Sawyer and Juliet, and I find this episode very interesting. Like, one of the interesting reveals is that we finally do figure out what it's going to take for their cover to break, because they are going through this assuming that if they do anything like this, if Sawyer goes and helps, then that's going to break the cover of the people that have been living in the Dharma. And I like that it is Juliet ultimately. Like, Sawyer has spent multiple episodes doing everything he can to keep the secret of who they really are and to keep them safe in Dharma. But when it comes down to it, when Juliet said it's time to do this because this is the right thing, I think that's a very powerful moment for Sawyer. And I think that that's a really sort of powerful moment when he says that he's doing it for her.
I agree.
And you know, it's big for the Kate and Sawyer dynamic, but it's mostly just a huge growth point for Sawyer in an episode where we did sort of go back down the path, you know, revisiting some of Sawyer's not so great moments in his life, you know, which like abandoning your child. I like
going to Australia to do a murder.
Well, so Cassidy's talking about Sawyer like he's never going to change. He's always going to be Sawyer. This is who he is. And we're seeing him be different. And I think it's in this episode, I feel like we see Jim LaFleur is a different man than the man that Cassidy encountered. And that's not, you know, Cassidy's correct in her experience. I'm not discounting her experience, but it all comes down to the central question of Lost, which is, can you change? Can you grow from who you were. It's so interesting because I saw a bunch of different interpretations as I was like reading some of the recaps at the time. I saw a couple different interpretations of this whatever happened episode title. One is, you know, the baseline, of course, has to do with this phrase we've heard over and over again as it pertains to time travel. But there's also this question of like, we talked about this before, but this idea of like whatever happened happened, like your past is your past and you can't change your past. But some people were asking, some people that I was reading, talking about the show were asking, like, can you change your future? Or is your inner Jack always going to emerge? Or can you become the John Locke you're aspiring to be? You know what I mean? Can you stay Jim LaFleur? Or is your inner Sawyer going to wild out? Like, what's gonna happen? And I just think that that's a really interesting thing that this episode is a little, you know, are you Kate? Are you born to run? Or, you know, are you running to something this time? And I just think that that's a really, you know, it's the meat of Lost, you know?
Yeah. It's a big theme to watch here in the old Lost.
All right, let's pick up a few more of these bits before we head to the corners. Kate remembers that she's a universal donor this time because season one taught her many things. Let someone else get your mangoes. Always remember your blood type. It could be important.
Yeah, I feel like Kate... like got off the island and she's like, okay, got a physical. I'm sure the Oceanic Six all went to had a health check. And she's like, what's my blood type? Cool. Never, ever forgetting that again, ever. Oh, I'm a universal donor. That would have been helpful multiple times, probably. Oh, well, now I know.
Yeah. I mean, it is good that they seem more capable at surviving now, given that they spent like 100 days on the island previously.
And it's not like that one time Jack made a bamboo needle and hooked himself up to it that he would have let Kate hook herself up to it even if he knew, because he was hardcore season one Jack at that time.
He might have like been willing to trade off with her, because like the reason he could have gone and helped with Claire giving birth. He could have hooked Kate up to on the old blood machine. Oh. And then gone and helped Claire, and then come back and hooked himself back up. But the reason he couldn't leave and help Claire is because he was literally tethered with a blood tube to Boone. So,
and he was about to take Boone's leg off
with a guillotine.
With an airline door. Great.
The Dharma Initiative has dresses. Just a note.
Well, we were discussing about like the Dharma jumpsuit colors, and we mm-hmm. were getting some feedback of like what color would you wear and what extra colors were there. There's a green jumpsuit, but I forgot that we saw back when Samantha Mathis was still on the show. Yeah. I'm pretty sure she's wearing like a Dharma Initiative dress when she's teaching. And then we saw in the background of the fire scene, a woman was wearing a Dharma Initiative dress. It looks very similar to the jumpsuit, but instead of like, you know, it's got like a jaunty little belt tie around the waist, and then it's like a khaki skirt mm-hmm. instead of like pants. So I just wanted to throw that out there. The Dharma dress, yeah. It's an option.
It seems great because, you know, warm climate in Dharmaville. Seems like it might be a problem in the jungle, though.
Yeah, you have to have a very specific job.
I would be sure that you're not leaving the camp.
Is it like Star Trek The Next Generation I could wear the dress?
Yes, I was going to say. It's like Picard's dress on Next Generation. Right. You should definitely wear the Dharma dress, Dave.
Well, it depends what my job is, but I feel like I would be safe, you know, with some exposed legs. And then, you know, the airflow. It's all important. Who does Richard work for? He apparently does not work for or Charles.
Definitely not Ellie or Charles.
Yeah, but he does work for somebody, as he makes an offhand comment in this episode. Just make a note of that. I bet we're going to have that question answered at some point. Who knows?
Yeah, I mean, it's on the list of Richard-related questions. I mean, the not aging thing, sure, that's up there. But also, yeah, who's his boss?
And then in the many things that are echoed, I think, from things that happen on the island or things that just the show likes to bring back as themes, we are once again in an episode where, like, Kate and Sawyer and Jack and Ben and Juliet are all tied up in a that we need to save Ben under a ticking clock plot, which, you know, Jack points out. But is this, like, a pattern because the show wants it to be, or is it a pattern because there's some sort of repetition going on? Whatever happened, happened-ness, but maybe, like, Star Wars, it rhymes.
It feels more intentional than, like, let's just give Saeed the same childhood backstory as Mr. Echo, because we only have a limited number of tragic bad dad backstories in our bucket. You know what I mean? Like, this feels like a much... You know, especially because they lampshade it, right? Like, that he calls it out. But I just do think that it's... I think it's really interesting. It never really occurred to me watching the show more casually that this is so much of an echo of that season three scenario. So, yeah, I just thought it was interesting.
Maybe it's trying to go back and correct its own mistakes. Being like, here's an exciting version of that. And you're like, ooh, yeah.
Dave and I have our own book on our brain constantly. Okay, we are the causes of our own... Speaking of which, I'll bring up Avengers Endgame, which I just watched yesterday. Not only is the, like, the time travel talk reminiscent of the time travel talk in Avengers Endgame, both of which center a lot on Back to the Future, mm-hmm. But I was just thinking about... I was watching Avengers Endgame yesterday, and, you know, there's that scene, spoilers for Avengers Endgame, when Cap is on is at the S.H.I.E.L.D. base, and he sees Peggy, but he doesn't say anything. And he just, like, looks, like, wistfully through the blinds into the other room at her, and mm-hmm. then he leaves. And it reminded me a lot of Sawyer, like, looking at Kate while she's delivering Claire's baby, like, in the jungle and not saying anything, just looking. But I was like, but you know what? If Giacchino were hitting me right now with a score in Avengers Endgame, I'd be weeping. And I'm not, I'm moved, but I'm not weeping. And that's just, I was missing the maestro, Michael Giacchino, in that moment. So mm-hmm. sorry, Alan Silvestri or whoever scored Avengers Endgame. Yeah. Let's talk I know we're gonna hit the corners really soon, but can we talk briefly about the time travel rules, because I have a question for you.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This is Dave's like, yes, I was born for this. All right. So this is there's two kinds of time travel narratives, right? There is Back to the Future, which is like you can change things, right? You can erase yourself from existence. You can make it so your dad is suddenly a successful author. Like, you know, your monkey around the past can change the future. And then there's, like, the 12 monkeys closed loop thing, right? Where, like, it's already happened. And even if you think you're affecting things in the past, really, you were always there doing that thing in the past, right? So yes. Our understanding of Lost is Kate and Sawyer Saeed always shot Ben, and Kate and Sawyer always took Ben into the jungle, and Ben always went into the temple and came back a little bit different, and, like, all of that always happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Because there's another option. There's a third option, which is you can change things in the past, but the ultimate outcome will still be the same. And that's more of the, like, kind of self-fulfilling prophecy sort of thing. So, like, let's say Ben got mortally wounded because he fell out of a tree in the past, and Richard found him and brought him into the temple, but the Losties weren't there, you know. But now that they're mm-hmm. there, Saeed's doing stuff, but it's still gonna wind up with the same result because of the way that time or the island corrects itself.
Right. The idea that, like...
Does that distinction make sense?
Yeah, because, like, it's the idea that, like, time is actively participating in a way that is, right. like, correcting. So it's yes. like the Desmond and Charlie thing, where it's like, Charlie was supposed to die, no right. matter what Desmond does, it will right. eventually happen.
Right.
So yeah, I mean, I guess there... I don't know. I'm interested to hear what Dave said, but that makes sense to me.
I generally don't know the answer. I'm curious. Dave, what do you...
In order to have that, I guess what you're describing as the third type of like mm-hmm. time travel storytelling. I think you have to introduce a little like Doctor Who-ness into it, where like they're fixed points. So mm-hmm. that way, like, certain things have to happen, right? Like, if every second the Earth could blow up or the Earth doesn't blow up and, like, we have the ability to change that, but then the Earth's going to, like, self-correct. It's not like the Earth is going to suddenly blow up. There has to be, like, some points in time that are fixed, some events in time that, for whatever reason, in your story world are important enough that the island is building to it or that the story is building to it. Something like Charlie's death, where it's going to happen no matter what, and there's no way of stopping it, even if you're Desmond, the person whose the rules don't apply to. Like, Charlie is always going to have to die because it has to bring Penny there, because we have to have three more seasons of the show. Like, that kind of mm-hmm. reads okay to me. If you get deep into it, which is then what Doctor Who does, to sort of have more fun with it, I think you have to establish one of those rules where it's like, yeah, you could change things. The island's going to self-correct. It's a lot more like a river. It's a lot less like a linear timeline sort of thing. Like the flow's going in the correct direction one way or the other, but you can't change where downhill is, you know?
Yeah, so the like idea... Oh, go ahead. Well, I was going to say the idea is that no matter what, Ben always ends up in that temple. How he ends up in the temple could have been changed, you know,
that's
by
the
these
third interpretation of time. Yeah.
So he's always going to end up in the temple no matter what.
If that's one of those Whovian fixed points sort of things. Mm-hmm. But I think we are working in that sort of, you can call it 12 Monkeys or like Prisoner of Azkaban, basically. Like, it was always Harry sending the Patronus to save Harry.
Yeah.
Right? Like,
do we want to spoil more movies? La Jetée, Looper.
La Jetée is just 12 Monkeys. That's just the same spoiler. So, you know. But
well, I mean, so is Looper. That's what I'm saying.
No, anyway. La Jetée is like little. Okay, anyway.
Yeah, no, I know from the hit. Okay. Joanna knows that La Jetée, the short, was adapted into 12 Monkeys directly, which is what she's talking about. And it also came up on the official Lost podcast this week.
Oh, did it?
It did.
Oh, that's so fun. Thanks, film class I took in college.
Yeah.
Yeah. And one last thing, you know, if the idea of this episode is that you can blame whoever you want. You can blame Saeed for shooting him. You can blame Jack for declining to treat him. You can blame Kate and Sawyer for bringing him to Richard. You can blame whoever you want. But ultimately, our losses were instrumental in creating Ben as he is.
Yeah.
So we are the causes of our own suffering. Literally, in this case. So,
although, I mean, do you think it's possible that even if Ben does not go through this traumatic experience, he still gasses the entire Dharmaville?
I don't know. The way Richard was talking about whatever's going to happen, we can't talk about whatever's going to happen to the temple, but it feels like a real, like,
dark turn for
Vader,
young Ben.
Vader moment for Ben.
I think he always would have done it.
All right, fair enough. I mean, he didn't seem like the world's nicest kid to begin with, but he also had a lot going on.
He seemed kind of nice. I don't know. Like, nice-ish. I don't know.
It's time for some corners. I'm going to jump in with the official podcast check-in because it was a short 19-minute podcast. It does have some emailed answered questions, but mostly it's teasing things that we're going to see in Dead Instead next week. So, but there is one update, which is Damon Lindelof and Carlton Cuse like to have a little nickname for the final scene in every season. It's so secret that only the people who are in it got the pages, the actual final pages for the final scene in season 5. And the fun nickname for season 5's conclusion is Fork in the Outlet. That's what we need to know. Also, they know we're wondering, did Ben kill Penny? And you're going to get answers to that in the future. They promise. Okay,
we better.
Yeah, that's right. And they're not just going to leave that around. Doesn't mean we have to go back to the docks
dangling.
Again. I would be happy not going back to the docks again, but we should, I guess, just to figure out what happened.
We'll never escape the docks, Dave.
Neil, We have a Giacchino corner this week.
We do. This one, not an iconic piece of music because it's played over Horace, I guess, interrogate, like Horace's announcement slash Jack's I'm trying to get myself in trouble moment. But it does have a fun name. It's called Your Karma Hit My Dharma. And karma spelled with a K-H, like Dharma with a D-H. So, you know, Giacchino was having fun here while he was scoring season 5.
Yeah. Not much more fun than, like, but he hasn't done, like, any Horace puns, right?
Yeah. Well, no, not yet. And honestly, this was a really easy episode for him because all the best Giacchino stuff is past tracks that they just reused. So.
Yeah, that's got to be the real... the real balancing act going into like the final seasons of something, being like, oh, when do I push myself and when do I hit those old buttons that I know I could just play the rap theme and I've got Joanna Robinson. This week's Jungle of Mystery moment, Richard just enters the temple, just like backs into the secret door and the beep, temple.
Beep, beep, beep. That's the sound of Richard backing up into the temple.
He's just saying that very quietly under his breath. He's beeping to himself.
Beep, beep. He's like, corner, because Richard used to work in a restaurant, so he knows.
Oh, yeah, good point. Points. All right, the Bood Carlisle Memorial Falling Down Award. I'm told, guys, this is very exciting. We have an email from the leader of the island himself. We have an email from Jacob.
Jacob did send us an email. We don't have a nominee for this corner, but we did have an email about it because we were discussing the nature of throwing and falling last week. So Jacob wrote in to tell us, I couldn't count the, he says, I couldn't count the amount of hours over all the podcasts I've listened to your voices, and I finally have a reason to write in. In He's Our You episode, you describe how Damon Lindelof argued about the hot pocket being thrown, not falling. As Neil said, Damon has indeed forgotten his basic high school physics. Once under only the influence of gravity, any object is said to be in free fall. Thrown, dropped, or even an object orbiting Earth are all technically falling. Love your work. Anxiously awaiting for Decoding Westworld to come back. Jacob. So, Jacob wants to remind us of physics.
In my mind, it's the gif of Jesse Pinkman screaming magnets, and I'm just like, physics! To the rescue.
Science, bitch! Yeah.
I love it.
Good. Excuse me, Mr. Lindelof. I think you're forgetting your high school physics.
Man of science, eh?
The I Married Her coincidence corner is Cassidy and Kate being back again. We sort of already touched on that. There's a question mark here because it's a soft coincidence. We don't get the moment. We don't get someone yelling, I married her. But it is...
I married her! There, I yelled it for you.
thank you. It is very coincidental-y. Ben's talking, so it's obviously a lie war. It actually goes to Kate this week, who grits her teeth and tells Roger, it's nice to meet you, Roger. Roger Linus, father of Ben Linus, man who kept me in a bear cage that one time. / other things. Made me build a runway that I still don't know why I built. Anyway.
So many bad things.
Yeah. Not a lot of good things that Ben did to Kate. It's, it creepily put me in a dress that one time and gave me breakfast.
That was the worst part. Mm-hmm. Breakfast was the worst part.
It was. Oh, woo, loo, loo! It's the best time travel moment, which is the entirety of Miles and Hurley this episode. Just making sure that the audience expectations are properly set. Whatever happened, happened. They could absolutely die. I think those are the important points outside of Miles saying that, you know, maybe they all blink out of existence and something goes wrong, rather than slowly fading like a Back to the Future thing. And I'm not sure how I feel about Miles and the like being like, just shoot me. It's like try to make a point. But for the most part, I'm all in favor.
He knows Hurley's not going to shoot him. Hurley,
that's a good point.
Never.
Yeah, Hurley would never.
I also love Miles saying, get used to it. Like, this is not going to get any easier to understand anytime soon. He's speaking to us.
Yeah, just direct address for that one. All right, it's time for the Jungle of Kistery moment. Every week, we let you vote via Twitter on who needs to be kissing. Joanna, how did we do last week for He's Are You? Did you manage to sneak a Rudzinski win in?
No.
No.
He didn't even get close.
He also didn't finish last, which I think is sort of disappointing.
Yeah, okay. I blame the chaos vote for that. Okay, last place is Saeed and Drugs, 17.3%. Rodzinski got in the Swan, so like his beloved Swan Station, 18.5% of the vote. Alana's Boot in Saeed's Face, which I thought would do a little bit better, 20.2% of the vote, but coming in hot. The Jumpsuit Gal Pals, Kate and Juliet, 44% of the vote. Mm-hmm. If you voted for that, good news. You'll have another chance. Because this week in the Whatever Happened Happened Kissery poll, we've got three Kate entries. Because this is, after all, as we said, or I said, this is probably my favorite Kate episode. Evangeline Lilly, super kissable lady. So let's just shout out her chemistry that she has with various people. Kate and Juliet are back. Back in the habit, saving children, you know, doing blood transfusions. They're good together. Cassie and Kate, who have won this poll before, gal pals, sister wives, co-moms, all that stuff. Good stuff. Miles and Hurley taking over for Hurley and Sawyer. The roommate bros, this is them sliding into that roommate bro spot with the time bro squabbling of Miles and Hurley. And then lastly, just because for that old Rodzinski twist of the knife, we've got Kate and Roger Linus. Should they kiss? Maybe.
Who's to say? You are. Go to Storm Podcast on Twitter and give us your vote. The most 1977 thing is all your best surgeons are incognito or babies, because Ethan, he doesn't know how to fix a baby Ben yet. All right, that joke didn't work.
The most 1977 thing is baby Ethan could have helped.
Yeah, baby Ethan could have helped. Baby surgery is a completely different show, but I would watch that show if the babies are, you know, like doing the surgeries.
Sure.
All right. The Charlie Pace Memorial Final Words Award goes to maybe Ben, who's never going to be the same, who says, "Tell my dad I'm sorry I stole his keys." Oh, Ben, don't make me feel bad for you. You're about to be island magicked into a guy who's going to gas everybody.
Yeah, tell my dad I'm sorry I stole his keys. By the way, I'm going to murder him in like a decade.
And we'll see.
What's the last thing that like Anakin Skywalker, like real Anakin Skywalker said? Do you think
that really Anakin Skywalker said?
Yeah, before he got swallowed by Sith garbage. We'll think about it. Okay.
Probably the last thing he said to his mother in Attack of the Clones, right? Because then he murders all the Tusken Raiders.
Oh, you think it's the Tusken Raider murder? Okay.
Oh, I mean, he definitely goes dark. So, I mean, that. Long, different podcast. Frank Lapidus, guess we're not going to Guam Act Break Award, goes to Sawyer, says, or goes to Jack, who responds to Sawyer. Sawyer says, "If you don't come with me, Jack, that kid's gonna die." And Jack says, "Then he dies." Like, you know, just the calmest thing you could possibly say. Very, very zen. And that's going to do it for the calm this week. Join us for the storm right after this.
Now is the time on the podcast where we like to thank our small council subscribers. Those are the patrons at the $10 level or above. They get access to everything that we have to offer. So we would like to thank Liz Zelikson, Gabby B., Deanne Miller, Rebecca Addison, Michael Hine, Aaron Michael Augustini, Joe Measures, Bryce Quine, Ira Storm, Melissa Slaughter, Great Ontos, Victoria McDuffie, Marianne Donnelly, Jim Scott, Cody Dragies, Fiona Grimm, Aaron, Brian Rapp, Holly Hunt, and Kelly Donahue. Thank you all so much.
And I would like to thank Ashley Reese, Tom Brady's Dexter Morgan, Bob Augustus, Soundwave 815, Ashley Lopez, Stacy Axelrod, Mike McLaughlin, Madison Ray, Carrie, Jason Blackmer, Robert Bowles, Chuck Parquet, Cameron Graham, Mark Jewett, Tom Shapansky, Mick Nick, James Barta, Jocelyn Land, Jeremiah Perez, and Micah Wood. Thank you very much.
And I would like to thank the following fine humans: Sarah Gates, Steve Bolvari, Jane Phelps, Brian Latino, Ben Block, Maggie Paulin, Benjamin Jacoby, Matt Hayes, Tiffany Welker, Laura Kaminsky, Wendy Marshall, Joseph Johnston, Brenda Moran, Russell Brody, Carrie Labadia, Nell, Samantha Sherburn, there we go, Georgia Monroe Cook, Trey Menchaca, and Rachel Warren. Thank you all very much for being members of the Small Council.
And we are back for the storm. We are getting towards the part of Lost where, like, things, we're getting to, like, the end of things, the last things. This,
like, the last time we're going to ever see Aaron as a toddler.
The last time we ever see toddler Aaron.
Bye-bye, baby.
Bye-bye, baby. This is the last flashback episode of one of the survivors of Oceanic 815. Look at me. Look at me in the storm. Mm. Saying the flight name, everything. Just
busting out the big words.
Yeah, there we go. and as somebody pointed out in our live watch, we're getting down to final outfits. Is this Kate's final outfit?
Yes, she wears the gray shirt with the jeans, but I think they sneakily change cut because
sometime when they're hanging out at the temple.
Because she's got, like, royal 70s jeans on now, and I think they become a little bit more artsy in the final season. I'll have to do a side-by-side comparison. Jackie is wearing the same t-shirt, the blue t-shirt. Juliet has yet to put on her stupid pink shirt that she dyes, and I hate that shirt so much. It's the ugliest thing Elizabeth Mitchell ever wears, and she dyes in it. Hate that for her. Hurley's finale shirt is brown, and he appears to have a red shirt on in this, and he and Miles still have some, like, tooling around, writing Star Wars and things to do, so they have chances still to change their clothes. But yeah, I think Kate and Jack are pretty close to their finale outfits here.
In the endgame outfits.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to be fun to track that
Is John Locke in his final t-shirt situation? I don't know, it's hard to see. It's very dark.
The old olive sort of situation.
I'm excited that this is not, like, linearly, this might be Richard's final outfit, but it's not the last look we're going to get from Richard. And I think that's an important reminder that we're eventually going to get long hair, dirty Richard.
Boy. Oh, boy. Spanish speaking Richard. Oh boy, we're gonna have a time. Looking at Kate's series finale jeans, yeah, maybe they're the same jeans. Actually, it's a great outfit. There's no reason for her to ever change it. Eventually, Lily should still be wearing that, as far as I'm concerned. So
yeah, it's the one she's gonna shoot John Locke in. It's gonna be great.
Hilariously, this photo that I'm looking at, like, both she and Jack have the, like, that, like, ring of chest sweat that people have all the time on Lost when they've been running through the jungle. But honestly, it just looks like Jack's shirt still hasn't dried from the shower.
And it didn't dry all the way through season 6.
Yeah. Which, in fairness, I was just looking at it because we were talking in my intro. I talked about this being, like, the second and third days after the Ajir crash. The end, the final episode of this series, takes place 14 days after the Ajira crash on the island. So there's only 11 more days of island time left in the series.
I am going to be watching Hurley's shirt. I'm unclear. It gets really dark maroon, but maybe that's just sort of like how the sweat is manifesting on it.
Sure.
There's
a lot more jungle stuff in season 6. Yeah. So
yeah, everybody running back and forth, making teams. Those teams.
When Claire shows up again, and you're like, "Oh no,
she's in a pit."
Oh, no.
And Kate's like, "I came back for you," and he's like, "Claire's like, he's coming for me," and you're like, "What?"
That's not when Claire comes back. Claire comes back when, like, Jin is injured in a, like, scary little, yurt situation in the jungle, and Claire rolls up, and
"It's very Rousseau season one."
No, it's 1,000% Rousseau. It's a very one-to-one Rousseau moment, but you're just sort of like, oh no. You at the same time as Jin are like, oh no. You're like, yay, it's Claire. Oh no.
Oh no.
So yeah, something to look forward to.
Yeah, the return of Claire and the worst wig Lost has to offer. All right, what else do we want to talk about in the storm?
I don't know. I don't know if there's a this Elizabeth Mitchell casting news out of the bag note here. I don't know what that means.
Oh, so I was reading Jeff Jensen's recap on The Entertainment Weekly, and he was talking about like whether or not he like shipped Juliet and Sawyer, Juliet and Kate. And he's like, listen, I really like Juliet and Sawyer, but if something were to happen to Juliet, like say, I don't know, she landed the lead on a new ABC show, which meant she's not going to be a series regular in the final season. He just put that, I mean, that was just out there, I guess. So, like, people knew that Elizabeth Mitchell wasn't going to be a series regular in the final season of Lost. Mm. So that just, you know, whether or not Jeff Jensen knew she died at that point, which he probably did, but whether or not he did, you know, he was like, well, something's going to happen that's going to take her, you know, out of the main cast. And if that's the case, you know, maybe it'll be great to have Kate there. But listen, it's no. I will
when,
give the show
in
this.
In fact, as we've discussed on In the Storm on this podcast, Kate is the one who murders Juliet.
No, as we've discussed in the Storm Sections podcast, the show V is the one that murders Juliet. But it's what a, I wish she hadn't taken that show. Anyway, something I do really admire about Lost is that they never have Kate and Sawyer, like, console each other. Right?
I miss her, too.
In a sexual way. Like, they have beautiful emotional moments together, but it's, you know, the show decides in the last minute, oh, it's about Jack and Kate all along. Let Sawyer grieve. It'll be fine. Anyway.
Yeah. I mean, I like that as the show putting importance on the relationship that Sawyer has with Juliet.
Yeah. I like the show's respect for it. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the fact that they don't really go back to the love triangle thing is good. 'Cause Juliet's a great character and it's going to be super sad at the end of the season when she goes out. You know, but at the time we didn't know that we were going to get the vending machine scene. And I guess, you know, Damon Carlton probably did at that point. So
maybe, but I mean, yeah. Yeah. I do like the Sawyer Juliet. There's still Sawyer and Kate like flirting at the being in the sideways. Right. 'Cause he's like the cop and she's the fugitive and they have that like fun flirty shit that they do. But like we save the real shit for Dr. Juliet Burke. Obstetrician extraordinaire, fixer of vending machines, crusher of hearts. Anyway.
Yeah, always willing to go Dutch. It's great.
It's not Sarah, it was Juliet. I'm looking forward to the Flash side
who's
more
David's
than I'm looking
mom?
Forward to the rest.
Yeah. Yeah.
All David's mom. All David's sideways mom.
She's the all mother, is that what you're saying?
Wow.
The sideways all mother.
Mm.
Okay.
I can't wait to start talking about sideways flashes again.
Can we talk about Dojin in the temple? I know there's. I will say. Here's what I'll say for the storm. All the recaps I've ever like. Wow, boy, oy, oy. Don't know what's going on in the temple, but it sure is gonna be amazing. I can tell. And I'm like, oh no, no, it's not.
I mean, you can see they thought it was, too. And then they got there and they had to write it. And it just didn't work out for whatever reason.
I mean, honestly, I think the temple was dumb. It's dumb by the end of season 5. Right? Because there's the sequence where, like, Ben goes to the temple.
With Ellie. Yeah. Yeah.
The temple, maybe not their best idea. I think this might actually be the best use of the temple, is the thing at the end of
just
this episode.
The doorway. Well, yeah. Don't forget the time that it ate some Frenchmen. You know, sure. That was pretty funny.
But they could have just left it, and it would have been just like this mysterious thing that we never come back to, and we get to wonder why it both healed Ben and turned him into a monster.
There's a parallel universe where there are a bunch of angry Lost nerds being like, "Oh, and they never showed us what was inside the temple," and we could like go visit that alternate universe and be like, "We promise, you're better off."
Right?
You
didn't want to know. You didn't
you
want
never
to know.
Wanted to know.
She was Palpatine's granddaughter.
In your version of the multiverse, they reunite Sun and Jin at the beginning of season 6.
Yeah. In my version of the multiverse, we were talking about this actually in the Storm channel on our Slack Patreon today, I think. This idea of is what does Saeed have left to do that's not bad on the show? Mm-hmm. He has some stuff to do at the end of this season, and then he gets like shot. There's like a little bit to do with the bomb plot, you know what I mean? But like, other than that, Saeed is mostly done with having a good story, which sucks.
Yeah.
Big time. And so then I was like, okay, well, if Saeed was going to die anyway, let's envision a multiverse where Juliet doesn't have to die.
They never make that stupid show.
They never make fucking V. Elizabeth Mitchell doesn't leave. Juliet doesn't have to die. Saeed dies instead. And I'll be sad, but Saeed, it'll be like a big damn hero moment for Saeed.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than the zombie plot, and then he has a hero moment. Like, he throws himself on a bomb anyway. It's just later and overshadowed by Sun and Jin dying, you know, moments later. So, like, give Saeed the big Charlie death here, and let Elizabeth Mitchell stay. I don't want Saeed to die at all. Actually, my ideal multiverse, he's, like, chilling, you know, somewhere, having a great time. Building more houses for people in other places. You know what I mean? But if he's going to die anyway, why not give him, like, more a better way to go out, you know?
Yeah.
That's what I would say.
Yeah, I mean, put him on Team Lapidus in season 6. It's just trying to actually get off the island and leave him out of all the mythical stuff.
Have him fix stuff. He's good at fixing stuff.
Yeah.
It's like, who is it? It's someone wild. I feel like it's Miles.
Yeah, I think Miles someone, ends like, up.
When they like finally have to take off in the plane, and like someone has to help like with the wiring down with the wheels, and it's someone like Miles, and I'm like, that guy doesn't know anything about this. Mm-hmm. Where's Saeed? Damn it.
Get Saeed's dead body here. You at least ask Miles can ask that.
Yeah, they do Saeed dirty. That's one of the more vivid things I remember from watching the first time, was that the conversations about loss that I would have with my mom got darker and darker, because she was, while this thing was airing, number one Saeed fan. Biggest Saeed fan you've ever met. And she, very understandably, was very mad at season 6 of Lost. So yeah. So that's a truth that we can go forward with, that Saeed gets done dirty in season 6.
And so just have like Juliet, you know, like what would it hurt for her to have Juliet there? Sawyer would be less sad. Like, Sawyer gets two extremely good scenes. One, I guess the vending machine wouldn't be for her. Okay, let me think about it. I'm going to keep thinking about it. But
sure. I'm sure it'll come up again.
Oh, yeah. It's the storm, aka where we talk about Juliet dying until Juliet dies. And then probably thereafter, except it'll move into the calm a little bit more. It's just a real painful moment for Lost fans, I think.
One could say that it's a major incident.
Oh, yeah. A fork in the outlet, maybe. If we're going to look out for some things next week, I am psyched, because here comes Antagonist Locke, where we get to not talk about Antagonist Locke in the calm. So if you're into the type of dancing around spoilers, as one of our emailers, reviewers, was earlier in this episode, get ready for Smoke Monster becoming he becomes Alex in the next episode, right? Mm. Yeah, Smoke Monster becoming Alex. Heavy hints that that's not Locke, but we're going to pretend like it is, right?
It's so obvious when you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'll be curious to see, like,
Shruti guesses.
Shruti, but when I read the recaps next week, I'll be really curious to see if people were like, how interesting that Locke is like, I'll wait here. You go down that hole. I'll definitely be here. And then we don't see him. And then the smoke monster appears as another dead person. And then we see Locke again, and he's like, whoa, what happened? Well, I guess you better do what she says. Anyway, we'll watch for ourselves, I suppose.
I'm just very excited to this period of the grand lie.
R.I.P. Caesar soon.
Yeah, R.I.P. Caesar. That's a good point.
Also, we get what I would argue is the handsomest version of Charles Widmore next week.
Ooh, which yes. Is like handsome Widmore.
Charles in his late 30s, early 40s sort of guy. It's great. Maybe another late Widmore. 20s, early 30s. I don't know.
Throw another Widmore on the pile.
No, I think he's like late 30s.
Sure. Well, and I love that the you know, we're going to get into Charles, and we get a little bit, do we get a little bit of Ellie next week? And we're starting to build toward the other secret, the other one that season 5 has been hiding from people, which is the big time loop of Dan and his
Dan.
Mom. Yeah, which I think is great because it really sneaks up on you, because this next episode, I think, will have people questioning what's going on with Locke to the point where they're going to miss, you know, like that the Ellie Daniel thing really sort of sneaks up on you at the end of the season. It's great.
Yeah, coming up on a lot of great season 5 stuff. What a great season. All right. Until then, just remind us, Neil, even though we've been talking about it, mm-hmm. Where do we go next week?
Well, next week, Dead is Dead. It is a Ben episode. It's a Ben and Charles and Alex is there and the smoke monster is there. And, you know, quote unquote, John Locke is there. So it'll be fun.
And until Dead is Dead, where could people find more of your work around the internet? Let's start this week with Joanne Robinson.
You can find me on vanityfair.com. We are launching the next iteration of Still Watching podcast, where we will talk about Falcon and the Winter Soldier. And you can find me on Twitter at JWritethis, not live tweeting the Justice League Snyder Cut.
And Mr. Neil Miller.
Well, you know, you can always get stuff that I've worked on over at filmschoolrejects.com. We're in the middle of our big monster bracket, and it really does seem like it might come down to Godzilla versus Kong. Who could have seen that coming? you can get me on Twitter at Rejects or at One Perfect Shot. That's a good one. And patreon.com/Storm of Spoilers. Jump in. An announcement is coming soon for the next show that we're going to be streaming together every day. The project continues, so it's going to be a lot of fun.
And I'm Dave Gonzalez. You can find me on Twitter at DA7E. You could find my thoughts about the Zack Snyder Justice League cut on next week's Fighting in the War Room. It is a podcast about movies and things. We talked about a whole bunch of things that we liked this week. No, I'm sorry. We just talked about Defending Your Life, an Albert Brooks movie that we liked. The other thing that we didn't like was Cherry. And then we talked about Oscar nominations.
I have a lot of Defending Your Life opinions. Okay, go ahead.
Well, that's good. You would enjoy this week's Fighting in the War Room. But more importantly, for you guys listening to this podcast now and listening all the way to the end, I know what you want to hear, and I'm here to provide it. Please do not fall down. You've heard from David Lindelof. Bad.